Welcome to the Deep Dive, Bloomberg Business Week for October 2025. I'm Pat Livingston.
And I'm Chris Sinclair. Our job today really is to sift through this past month's business news, pulling out the critical stuff, the surprising bits from this issue.
Exactly. And this October issue, wow, it paints a picture of a world moving at, well, completely different speeds, doesn't it?
It really does.
On one side, you've got this incredible acceleration of tech AI creating, you know, almost anything, finance going decentralized.
But then flip side, you see all this friction, policy messes, things falling apart, just deep anxiety across society.
Yeah, total fragmentation. So we're going to try and connect those dots for you. We're going from these like 8-second viral videos of rabbits.
Rabbits on trampolines, Noah.
Right. Rabbits on trampolines, all the way to public health systems basically collapsing. And what's next for global leadership and money and science? It's a lot.
It is a lot. And we have to start where that speed and that fragmentation are just clashing head on. The digital frontier. The remarks section kicks it right off, asking, you know, is all this disruption a revolution in content or just, well, digital junk?
Or as they're calling it, AI slop. I kind of love that term.
Me too. It just nails it.
It captures that feeling, right? Low effort, potentially huge return. And the prime example they give is bunnies, wild rabbits on a trampoline.
It started with this guy, Andy Kasofsky. He's like 22, works in marketing. And he was just messing around with Google's video tool, VO3.
Yeah, just tinkering. And it shows how the creative power is shifting, isn't it? It's all in the prompt now.
Totally. He teched in something like grainy night vision security footage, wild rabbits bouncing on a trampoline. But then he added the key bit.
The viral hook.
Exactly. Make sure one of the bunnies disappears. Gives it that slightly weird, unsettling edge.
And this little 8-second clip posted under this generic name, Rachel Thicket Lovers. It just exploded.
Exploded is right. Over the next few weeks, 237 million views.
Stop and think about that number for a second, you. 237 million. That's like double the live audience for the Super Bowl.
Double the Super Bowl. For an 8-second clip made with basically zero budget, no set, no actors, just a clever prompt, pure surrealism.
It's kind of mind-blowing, and it forces this whole slop or revolution debate right out into the open.
Yeah, the critics, you know, the old media types, they just write it off. Unimaginative dreck, they call it. Anthropomorphized animals, lowest common denominator stuff, just to game the algorithm.
But then you look at who can make this stuff now. It's a huge shift in access, isn't it?
Absolutely. Henny Farid, he's an engineering professor at Berkeley. He makes this great point. He says, look, a teenager somewhere now has tools that used to require like multi-million dollar budgets.
And huge crews, unions, the whole Hollywood setup.
Right. That whole cost structure gone overnight.
And maybe the driving force isn't always, you know, high art. It's often just about the money. Which brings us to Jonathan Punsky and his dog pack company.
Right. They started with a pet social networking app and they needed marketing. So they used AI to create the podcast.
Oh, God, the podcast. Those videos are something else. AI dogs in a studio telling terrible dad jokes.
So cringe, like physically painful cringe. But it works. It drives people to their app.
Because as the article points out, people are maybe getting tired of that super polished, look how great my life is content. They just want entertainment, even if it's, well, dumb entertainment.
Yeah, even if it's painful dad jokes from AI dogs. Hmm. And the creators aren't even hiding it.
No, they're totally upfront. Like Ali Sultan in Pakistan making those bizarre food mashups. Mm-hmm. People jumping onto beds made of cheese.
Or chocolate.
Yeah.
It's just weird stuff. And he straight up says, you got to play with people's psychology. It's clickbait.
That's the whole business model right there. Make the weirdest, most algorithm-friendly thing you can think of.
But that playing with psychology leads straight into intellectual property chaos, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. They mentioned this 13-year-old Kabir Rajdev in New York. He used Veo 3 to make tons of clips of Star Wars stormtroopers.
Just hanking out, calling each other bro.
Yeah, talking about boring stuff. And he made like $1,500 from sponsors doing it.
And the comments were apparently loving it. Right. Saying it was way better than Disney.
Which is kind of a brutal takedown of Disney's control, right?
But
it also shows there are zero rules here. A total regulatory vacuum.
Yeah. Stormtrooper saying bro seems harmless. But the tech behind it? That's the same tech used for deepfakes. Like that fake Zelensky surrender video we saw? That's dangerous.
Seriously dangerous. And Sahana Udupa, this media anthropology professor, she points out the absolute minimum platforms should do.
Just label it right. Automatically tag AI-generated videos.
Just that basic step. And they're not even doing that.
Why not? because engagement equals ad revenue, whether it's bunnies or political lies. If people click, the platforms make money.
So tech prefers the cash flow over, you know, actually moderating this stuff. And we're just left
holding our breath, as the article says, hoping the next viral thing isn't something truly damaging.
That tension, you know, between the viral absurdity and the potential for real chaos, it perfectly sets up this next story, the Enron parody that tried to become real.
Oh, this one is wild. Connor Katos, the guy behind Birds Aren't Real.
He really committed to this Enron bit, didn't he? It was immersive.
Totally. A full rebrand. Billboards, social media ads, those creepy I am Enron ads with, like, farmers and pregnant women. Just bizarre.
Implying this return to corporate goodness or something.
But the moment it really crossed the line from satire to something else was when they actually filed an application.
With the Texas Public Utility Commission to sell electricity as Enron.
They were trying to make the joke real. A functional utility.
And he didn't just file papers. He bought a real trucking company in Texas.
Slapped the Enron logo on the side with the slogan, "Nuclear you can trust." Made it look like they were actually delivering a reactor. It was intense.
His whole philosophy is fascinating, though. He basically says, look, Trump got elected twice. The line between absurd performance art and reality is already gone.
Which is a chilling thought. But the joke really soured when crypto got involved.
Ah, the Enron token. Launched in February.
And even with the disclaimer saying it was parody, it hit a market cap of, what, $700
million? $700 million for a joke coin based on a dead fraudulent company. Insane.
The crash was obviously coming, and it came fast. Two early investors, apparently not part of the core art team, cashed out.
Made about $9 million between them.
And boom. Market collapses instantly.
But the inside story is even messier, right? The article suggests the token wasn't maybe part of the original artistic plan.
Yeah, it seems like an outside investor pushed for it, wanted a big return. It caused a huge fight. The co-founder left.
And the team realized they weren't satirists anymore. They'd become
victims of a reanimated version of the original Enron fraud. That's a direct quote. Pretty damning.
It really is. But, you know, if he filed a real application to sell power and launched a token that basically rugged everyone, doesn't the system bear some blame? The regulators, the crypto exchanges.
You'd think so. But the system's built for speed, not for handling performance art messing with real-world finance. It just can't keep up.
When Gatos finally talked about it, he admitted they needed outside cash to buy the actual Enron.com domain to make the joke work.
And in taking that money, he said, you just become what you're satirizing.
Wow. Just the perfect, bleak moral for our times. Chase scale and you might just recreate the monster.
Yeah. And that idea of systems breaking down,
yeah,
it's a stark contrast to the digital chaos. But it leads us right into the physical, structural decay happening in U.S. public health. The in-context section really lays it bare.
Okay, let's shift gears to that. The assault on U.S. public health, starting with the CDC. The picture painted under the new HHS Secretary RFK Jr. is grim. Intentional destruction, basically.
Like immediate life or death results. Look at measles.
A disease we thought was gone in the U.S., eradicated 25 years ago.
Now it's back. Spreading fast among unvaccinated kids in West Texas. Gaines County got hit hard. It's the highest number of measles cases in the U.S. in 3 decades.
30 years. And the CDC's response during this outbreak?
Silence. They were put on a communications pause,
yeah.
Couldn't talk to state partners, couldn't publish data, couldn't coordinate anything publicly.
Just crippled. And it's not just silence, it's the structural damage.
Thousands laid off since Kennedy took over. Experts in chronic disease, logistics, gone.
And then they fired the entire vaccine advisory panel, the influential one.
The whole panel, replaced them with vaccine critics.
And pushing unproven stuff like vitamin A for infectious diseases.
Yeah, it's ideology driving policy, reframing vaccination as purely personal choice, not a public health imperative.
Richard Besser, the former acting director, called it incredible destruction. He warned this damages the U.S. role globally, too. We lose leadership in tracking diseases.
Kennedy defends it, of course. Calls the firings necessary adjustments for credibility. But the reality is loss of expertise, loss of institutional memory, just devastating.
And it goes beyond the main CDC functions, doesn't it? It hits NIOSH, too.
Right, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health. Most people probably haven't heard of it, but it's crucial.
Tell us what they do, because it's easy to overlook.
NIOSH handles workplace chemical risks, mine safety, healthcare for 9/11 survivors. And really importantly, They test and certify N95 masks.
So you know the mask you buy actually works.
Exactly. And they do all this for about $1 per American per year. Tiny cost.
And the plan is to cut their budget by 80%.
80%. It's not a cut. It's an elimination, basically.
And it's already causing paralysis. Scientists called back from research trips, banned from communicating.
Yep. Halts research on everything from workplace opioids to safety for EV manufacturing, EV fires.
And the business impact is immediate too, right? That PPE certification program zeroed out.
So on. Which is potentially fatal for companies like Dentech Safety Specialists. Their whole business is certified respirators.
The co-founder, Claudio Donte, said his business would be worthless without NIOSH certification. The market would just flood with cheap, untested masks.
Even John Henshaw, who ran OSHA under George W. Bush, a Republican, said the cuts were too much. His quote was, "The chainsaw had too big of a blade."
It just undermines U.S. leadership in workplace safety. And you lose scientists who just leave the field.
Yeah, a whole generation potentially lost. That fragility in public health systems, it mirrors a fragility we're seeing in finance, which brings us to stablecoins.
Right, the threat they pose to community banks. Let's unpack that.
The comparison being made is to money market funds back in the 70s. They offered better rates, sucked deposits out of banks,
forcing local banks to find more expensive ways to fund themselves.
Exactly. Stablecoins could do the same, but much, much faster.
Okay, remind us, stablecoins are digital assets, pegged usually to the U.S. dollar, but often issued by non-banks, right?
Correct. And crucially, they aren't FDIC insured, even if the money backing them sits in a regular bank.
So the big threat is people pulling their money out of local banks.
That's the core risk. Small lenders need those deposits. It's their cheapest way to fund loans for local businesses, farms, you name it.
And the incentive to move money is huge. Coinbase offering 4.1% on USDC.
While the average U.S. checking account pays, what, 0.07%?
It's not even close, so why should you, the listener, care?
Well, if you live in a rural area or depend on small business loans, this matters. When deposits leave your local bank, there's less money available for those loans.
Less credit access for farmers, for small businesses.
Precisely. The Treasury Advisory Committee warned something like $6.6 trillion could get pulled out of banks. That money tends to flow to the mega banks, not back to the communities.
Bill Bickle from Stockman Bank in Montana basically said, rural America, especially farmers and ranchers, will have less access to credit if this happens.
It's another case of tech moving way faster than regulation, potentially destabilizing essential community finance.
Okay, shifting continents now, but sticking with structural challenges. South Korea's demographic crisis.
Yeah, the lowest birth rate in the developed world. It's an existential threat there. Workforce, pensions, everything.
And the solution, or at least an attempt at one, is coming from corporations.
From the boardrooms, yeah. The big example is Booyoung Co., this huge construction firm. In 2024, they announced a massive incentive.
100 million won. That's about 72,000 U.S. for every baby born to an employee.
And they made it retroactive to 2021.
72 grand. That's double South Korea's average annual income. That is serious money.
And it worked, at least initially. They had 28 employee babies last year, more than usual. Other big companies, like Kraft and the game developer, jumped in too, offering big bonuses.
The corporate logic is kind of cold, but makes sense. Yeah. Cheaper to pay people to have kids now than run out of workers and customers later.
Exactly. And it seems to be nudging the national numbers slightly. The birth rate went up a tiny bit last year, first time in ages. Rose about 7% early this year.
But is it sustainable? Or just elaborate PR? Can corporate bonuses really fix a deep societal issue driven by cost of living, housing?
Probably not on their own. But it's definitely helping those specific companies with recruitment and retention. The article said no one who got the Booyoung bonus has quit.
So it stabilizes their workforce, gets good press. But fixing the national demographic cliff, that seems like a job for government policy, not just corporate cash.
Agreed. It highlights the scale of the problem when companies step in like that.
Okay, let's swing back to the U.S. and another area of friction, American farmers. Communities that heavily supported Trump are now struggling under a second trade war.
Yeah, the mood has soured quite a bit. They expected support, but got trade instability instead, piled on top of pandemic issues and high debt.
And there are real human costs. They mention Randy Rokucker in Wisconsin, forced to sell his family farm.
And calls to farmer mental health hotlines are way up. It's a crisis.
Yet, politically, support holds. The article says 53% of rural voters still approved of the president in August.
It's fascinating, isn't it? They're either hoping the tariffs work out long term or maybe expecting another big bailout like the first term.
But the quote from Farmer Stafford Sheridan is telling, worried they won't be in business to benefit from that long-term reward.
It really shows how deep political loyalty can run, sometimes even against immediate self-interest.
Finally, in this section on global friction, U.S. leadership in science is being challenged by budget cuts at home, specifically space research.
Yeah, it's about funding for major U.S. astronomy projects down in Chile in the Atacama Desert. Ideal spot for telescopes.
We're talking about the Giant Magellan Telescope, the GMT.
That's the one. Huge international project. But it needs about $1.3 billion from the U.S. National Science Foundation, the NSF, to get finished and running by 2035.
And if that funding doesn't come through,
the U.S. risks losing its leading edge in ground-based astronomy. Europe is fully funding its similar project, the Extremely Large Telescope. They'll attract the top talent.
And it hits the pipeline too, right? Fewer grants means fewer grad students, fewer postdocs.
Exactly. One professor basically asked, what's the point of building these amazing telescopes if we don't have the young researchers funded to analyze the data?
It's that classic disconnect. Wanting to be the leader, but cutting the funding needed to actually lead.
As one project manager said, you can't claim leadership while cutting funds. Can't go together.
Okay, so that sets the stage for how corporations and media giants are trying to navigate all this turbulence. Let's talk about the CEO guide to getting what you want out of Trump.
This piece really digs into the transactional nature of the presidency. It argues that understanding Trump's fixation on, well, getting awards and gifts is key.
His frustration about not having a Nobel, bragging about golf trophies.
Right, and corporations figured out you have to play to that. Give personalized praise, tangible symbols of respect.
The prime example is Apple, isn't it? Tim Cook dealing with the threat of chip tariffs.
Huge threat. Billions on the line. So Cook shows up with a plan. First, the big public promise. $100 billion in U.S. manufacturing investment.
And second, the gift.
The crucial gift. Something unique tailored to Trump. A glass Apple logo.
On a 24-karat gold base.
Exactly. Pure personalized bling. And Cook walks out with the tariff exemption Apple needed. That's the playbook.
And we see it elsewhere too. NVIDIA and AMD keeping China sales open.
By agreeing to give the U.S. government a 15% cut of that revenue. Highly unusual.
And the Nippon Steel takeover of U.S. Steel, approved only after giving the government a golden share.
Giving the administration veto power over big decisions. What's wild is how the ideological ground has shifted.
Used to be Republicans would scream socialism at stuff like this, right? Rand Paul called the Intel deal that.
Totally. But now, that free market resistance seems mostly gone, at least when it comes to securing access through these kinds of personalized transactional deals where the government gets directly involved.
Interesting. Okay, shifting from U.S. politics to European media. Matthias Döpfner at Axel Springer, big plans for U.S. expansion.
Yeah, Döpfner got this huge windfall when KKR bought Springer's classifieds unit, billions in cash. Now he controls the media side, Politico and others, and wants to grow big in the U.S.
And his big bet is on AI, right? Calls it the new gold.
He had this epiphany moment with ChatGPT, compared it to seeing the first website or the iPhone. He saw the future and moved fast.
Springer made that early deal with OpenAI, licensing their archives for AI training.
Which created a totally new revenue stream. Just licensing old IP, making money on a daily basis, as he put it. And their German tabloid, Bild, has a successful chatbot driving engagement.
So super forward-looking on tech, but the company culture sounds kind of old school and maybe controversial.
Definitely. Mandatory 4 days in the office.
Yeah.
And the Berlin HQ is famous for having like 250 dogs wandering around. They even have dog psychologists vet them.
Okay, that's unique. And Döpfner himself has faced controversy.
Yeah, leaked internal texts about Muslims, East Germans, his ties to Elon Musk. It's a complex picture. Tech, visionary, aggressive expansionist, but also someone with rigid views and a history of inflammatory comments.
Got it. Now let's jump to Hollywood. New leadership at Paramount, David Ellison.
Youngest CEO of a major media company, just 42. Backed by his dad, Larry Ellison's money, of course.
And he's trying to shake things up at Paramount, which has been struggling. His mantra is LFG.
Let's fucking go.
Yeah.
Aggressive moves, like that UFC deal, paying way over the odds for the rights. He wants premium, must-have content.
And bringing in Cindy Holland from Netflix to fix Paramount Plus thing.
Which desperately needs fixing. High subscriber numbers, but people cancel constantly. They need stickier content.
But his real ambition seems to be scale, right? Immediately eyeing Warner Bros. Discovery.
He thinks merging two struggling giants is the only way to compete with Netflix and Disney. Needs that massive scale. It's all about size and speed, even while making unpopular moves like forcing everyone back to the office 5 days a week.
But while the execs chase scale, what's happening on the ground for Hollywood workers? The article paints a bleak picture. It's not just temporary disruption anymore.
No, the contraction feels permanent now. It's the new normal.
And the human cost is brutal. Nancy Siner, the costume designer, worked on huge films.
Assistant translation.
Worked 16 days this year. Had to borrow money for her mortgage. Says she's losing her life's work, her industry family. It's heartbreaking.
And it's hitting mid-level people hard, too. Michael Chin, the development exec, described how senior people, desperate for work, are taking jobs below their level.
Boxing out the mid-career folks trying to move up.
Right. And he also mentioned it's hitting people of color particularly hard as studios get more risk-averse, sticking to the safest projects.
But this pressure is also forcing some creators to just leave the system entirely.
Yeah, like April Cordokio, the writer-director. A year without work, so now she's just making her own short film, free market style, bypassing the studios, seeking autonomy.
That idea of creator autonomy comes up again in the Screen Time spotlight, doesn't it, with Mrs. Rachel.
Rachel Accurso, massive YouTube star. The modern Mr. Rogers, basically. Zillions of views, huge deals with Netflix, books, toys.
Built on these simple educational videos for toddlers. But now she's using that platform for activism, her advocacy era.
Exactly. Using Instagram, TikTok to talk about her Christian faith and very openly about the suffering in Gaza.
Which is a huge deal for someone with her reach. And the key is she can do it autonomously.
No studio PR team breathing down her neck. She's working with Palestinian writers, race consultants. She said it herself. In the creator economy, you can keep your morals and ethics. Total opposite of old Hollywood control.
We also see Kenigra Dion, the Tyler Perry of YouTube, building a huge audience with scripted series featuring black actors.
Vampire Siblings, the messy group chat, billions of views. And now she's moving into feature films. Shows a path from creator to established pro outside the old gatekeepers.
And globally, the box office numbers show a real shift too. That Chinese animated film, Ni Zatu,
grossed $2 billion worldwide. Highest grossing film of the year. And set the record for biggest gross in a single market, beating Star Wars.
But almost all of that money, like 98%, came from China itself.
Right. Only 2% international. Whereas Hollywood films still rely heavily on global markets, often over half their revenue.
So China can create these massive domestic blockbusters that don't need the rest of the world, while Hollywood still depends on that global reach, even as the market fragments. Interesting dynamic.
Definitely. Okay, let's bring this back home. Focus on how economic stress is hitting everyday folks and the wellness cheats people are turning to.
Starting with how we even measure that economic stress, the argument is that the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, is flawed.
Yeah, Gene Ludwig, former controller of the currency, makes this case. CPI tracks like 80,000 items, sports tickets, golf carts, stuff that low and middle income families aren't buying when they're struggling.
So it doesn't reflect their actual cost of living. His alternative is the TLC, the True Living Cost Index.
Right. TLC only tracks necessities. Mm-hmm. Housing, medical care, transport, groceries, basic needs. And the finding is stark. Since 2001, TLC has gone up 1.3 times faster than CPI.
The gap is huge in key areas, like housing and healthcare.
Massive. CPI says housing up 90% since 2001. TLC, based on actual rents, says 131%. Medical costs doubled by CPI, nearly tripled by TLC, because of insurance premiums people pay out of pocket.
So that explains why people feel like they're struggling more than the official numbers show. The official numbers aren't measuring the reality.
And the bottom line is brutal. Adjust wages by TLC, and the median worker's pay has actually fallen over the last 20 years.
Fallen, despite nominal wage growth. Wow. That level of struggle makes sense why people might look for shortcuts, right? Especially for health and wellness.
Absolutely. If the economy feels rigged, maybe you look for a cheat code for your body or mind, which leads us to ketamine therapy.
The anti-anxiety cheat code. It works fast for depression, unlike traditional meds.
And because doctors can prescribe it off-label, these telehealth companies like MindBloom and Joyous just ship ketamine lozenges directly to people. No regular therapy required.
And it's way cheaper, right? Like $130 a month versus hundreds for in-person therapy sessions.
That cost difference is huge. But the experts are really worried about this unregulated market. They say it pushes this idea of ketamine as a simple mood optimizer.
Gerard Santacor at Yale warns it's naive and misguided to just swap SSRIs for unsupervised ketamine use.
Yeah, the companies downplay the risks. Addiction potential, problematic use, even serious physical harm, like long-term bladder damage. It's not a simple fix.
Seems like a theme. The search for quick fixes also fuels the peptide trend.
Totally. Beyond the weight loss drugs, you have all these other peptides, NAD, tesamorelin, BPC-157, promising anti-aging, better workouts, faster recovery.
Hyped by celebrities, influencers, Joe Rogan, Andrew Huberman.
And the appeal to high performers is clear. They quote this CEO, William Stern, busy dad, felt run down, used tesamorelin, called it a cheat code to being a hero, wanted his kids to see him as strong.
So people are stacking these injections, trying to optimize everything.
Yeah, BPC-157 for recovery, CJC-1295 for growth hormone. It's biohacking taken to the extreme.
Which loops back to the defense of the Lil cheat. The idea that these shortcuts can actually help you build good habits.
That's the argument, like the Catalyst EMS suit, the electric muscle stimulation thing.
The author tried it, right? Wore the wetsuit, got zapped.
Lost 10 pounds, gained muscle. And that initial success, that cheat, gave them the motivation to actually focus on the hard stuff. Diet, sleep.
So the cheat code acts like a placebo, maybe? Or just gets you psychologically into the game?
That's the idea. It provides the boost needed to commit to the real, unscalable work of long-term health.
Interesting take. Okay, from adult cheats to kid snacks. The better for you market is huge, $15 billion. But is it actually better?
Often, no. The bar for better is incredibly low. They mentioned organic Pop-Tarts with a third more sugar than the regular ones.
More sugar? That's crazy. So parents need to ignore the front label and just read the nutrition facts.
Pretty much. Check added sugar, sodium, look for fiber, protein. If it looks almost the same as the regular snack, you're probably just paying more for marketing hype that preys on guilt.
But there's a deeper, more worrying issue here than just sugar, right? About the food's texture.
Yeah, this is alarming. All the soft processed foods, the fruit pouches, the mushy snacks, smoothies. They link it to a lack of jaw development in kids. Comes from the book Jaws.
Because kids aren't chewing enough?
Yeah.
Seriously.
Seriously. Chewing rigorously helps develop strong jawbones, open airways. Without it, you see more bad teeth, sleep apnea, even permanent changes to facial structure.
Wow, that's a huge potential downside to convenience food we probably don't think about.
It's this softness epidemic. Parents trying to offer variety and easy options might be unknowingly causing developmental problems.
Okay, let's wrap this section with those CEO productivity hacks. Seems like they often favor simple consistency over complex tech.
A lot of it is about the morning. Kurt Geiger, CEO, up at 4.47 a.m. for focused thinking. Carlsberg, CEO, relies on FSN fitness, sleep, nutrition.
And avoids in-flight Wi-Fi for deep work time. Smart.
Others maximize movement. REI's CEO takes calls while walking. And sometimes it's about subtraction.
Like Finley Park's CEO deleting social media.
Yep. Less distraction, no longer being the product. Simple, but effective.
Okay, final section. Let's dive into culture, arts, and lifestyle, starting with the art world and Anselm Kiefer.
The German artist is having a major resurgence after decades, somewhat out of the North American spotlight.
His work deals heavily with German history, WWII trauma, scarred landscapes, those provocative Nazi salute self-portraits. Why now?
The argument is it connects directly to our turbulent times. Yeah. War in Europe again, global instability.
Yeah.
His art about conflict and historical weight just resonates differently now.
As the expert quote says, history becomes a psychological crutch in uncertain times. Makes sense.
Shifting from historical weight to luxury weight, Chanel's new watch.
The J12 blue, first new ceramic color since 2003. Why is a blue watch significant?
It's about cementing their status as serious watchmakers, not just fashion watches. They've invested heavily in high-end Swiss movement makers, Canisi, FP Jern, MB&F.
So the mechanics inside are top tier.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the subtle navy blue, moving away from the stark black or white, signals that sophisticated, if you know, you know luxury. You're wearing serious horology, but not shouting about it.
Subtle luxury, okay. And from watches to rose petals. Rose is having a culinary moment.
As an ingredient, yeah. Moving beyond just perfume or sickly sweet desserts.
Like those rose petal pancakes at Little Hen or Noma Project's wild rose vinegar.
Exactly. The advice is to use it delicately, like vanilla or cinnamon. Adds a floral depth, boosts other flavors, shouldn't taste like soap.
Right. Moderation is key. And speaking of taste in unique spaces, Death & Co. is getting into hotels.
David Kaplan's new venture, Midnight Auteur Hotels. starting in Savannah. The idea is to create those cool, bespoke third spaces that the boutique hotel scene used to have before the big chains bought everything up.
Focusing on smaller U.S. markets, aiming for 50, 120 rooms per hotel.
Yeah, about 10 planned across the U.S. And the big news is he plans to actually sell the Death & Co. cocktail brand itself in a few years.
Really? Sell the whole brand?
To focus entirely on the hotels. He sees that curated hotel experience as the future.
Wow, that's a major pivot. Okay, finally, quick culture picks for October.
Books? Cory Doctorow's In Shitification, finally formalizing that term for platform decay, and Marissa Meltzer's biography of Jane Birkin, It Girl.
Movies. Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein is finally here, with Jacob Elordi as the monster and Kelly Reichardt's the mastermind.
And streaming. That Victoria Beckham docuseries looks juicy, and season 2 of Nobody Wants This, that surprisingly funny rom-com.
Great picks. So looking back at this whole issue, what's the big takeaway? What's the common thread?
I think it's that core tension we talked about at the start. This incredible speed and scale of tech, the AI, the stablecoins, the corporate attempts to engineer demographics or pivot businesses.
Running smack into the messy, fragile, very human realities.
Exactly. Public health collapsing, real economic pain driving people to cheat codes, Hollywood workers losing their livelihoods. Tech accelerates, but it hits the wall of human friction and policy failure.
You really see it everywhere in the issue. The contrast is stark.
And that culture piece mentioning paranoia, referencing films like Bugonia, where the character thinks aliens are enslaving us, it felt relevant.
How so?
The screenwriter said, maybe the character's diagnosis is wrong, but his symptoms are right. That feeling of being abused by the system, disconnected, lost in the chaos, that resonates, doesn't it? It feels like the background noise of our lives right now.
Yeah, that feeling of structural uncertainty, it really does.
Yeah.
So if this era is defined by that tension, AI slop on one side, deep human paranoia on the other, and everyone's looking for a shortcut.
A pill, a suit, a crypto token.
Is the real cheat code something else entirely? Maybe it's not a product you buy. Maybe it's that unscalable work the CEO has talked about.
The simple stuff. Critical thinking, emotional resilience.
Yeah. The ability to actually question the chatbot, question the official narrative, question the marketing claims, instead of just taking the easy route. Maybe that's the only real way to navigate all this. Just something to think about.
It usually comes back to the hard work, doesn't it? The stuff no AI can do for you.
Indeed. Well, thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the October 2025 issue of Bloomberg Businessweek. We'll catch you next time.